This message, entitled Making Sense of the Brave New World by Roger Smith, was recorded at Mobilize, part of the New Frontiers Together in a Mission Conference 2008 in Brighton.
Well done. Who was in the seminar with me yesterday? Could you just... Oh, it's about half and half. Excellent. Okay. Must have upset the other half. Today doesn't follow on in a sense from what we did yesterday, but we will be referring briefly to stuff which we've already covered yesterday. But this morning we have this subject of making sense of the brave new world, which is a very brave title, I think, because I'm not entirely sure we will make a lot of sense of the brave new world, but at least we can at least have a look at it, see if we like it, have some reflection on it, and see where you might be in 50 years' time, because I'll probably be dead, but, well, actually, I'll definitely be dead by then. You'll still be going on, and you'll have some of these challenges to come in your middle age and your older years as well. So, up to you, really. So we'll see what you think as we go along. Just to put this in context, really, if the 19th century was seen as the age of the machine, the 20th century... seen as the information age, my guess is that the 21st century is going to be the age of biotechnology. And a friend of mine who I'll refer to in just a minute has said, Professor Cameron has said, that he considers that the greatest challenges within the 21st century for the whole of mankind will be this question, what does it mean to be human? And we'll try and unpack that a bit together as we talk this morning. And the biotechnology challenges are many and various. You know, this is a century when there's all sorts of promise that we might be able to see a cure for genetically linked diseases, maybe such as Alzheimer's, that kind of disease, cystic fibrosis. We may well see a cancer vaccine at some point. Maybe even a cure for AIDS, who knows? But there's a possibility of all those things happening in the next few decades of this century. We're obviously going to see some amazing developments in food production as well. There's all sorts of GM possibilities. Now, I don't know how you feel about GM foods. We're not specifically going to talk about that this morning, but there is the possibility of GM foods being engineered to contain therapeutic drugs, which could help people in particular places and situations. Some people argue that we will see the next stage of human development within this century as well, taking us into what's described as a post-human age. You thought you were just dealing with a post-Christendom age. Well, we'll think this morning about what a post-human age might look like if we ever get there. It's quite a prospect, really. But of course, all of this new thinking, all of these new ideas, all the science brings with it a whole load of ethical and particularly as well for us, theological challenges as well. The scientist, as I think I said in your notes, there you go. The scientist will say, if it can be done, then it must be done. The ethicist will ask a different question, and the ethicist will say, even if it can be done, should it be done? And of course, for those of us who claim to have a Christian worldview, and that's obviously what we've been talking about a lot here in this conference, we're going to be asking questions, well, yes, but what does the Bible have to say about this as well? What are the biblical principles, if you like, that I've got to bear in mind as I think through some of these issues? I guess the straightforward answer to that question is it's all the big topics that you'll find in the Bible. There won't be many proof texts that you'll find to deal with nanotechnology or robotics or all the other type of issues that we can think about today. It's the big issues about God being sovereign that we've also heard about this at the conference. God as creator, God as sustainer of life. The fact that human beings are special in God's creation, made in the image of God. No other part of creation has that privilege. So those are the kind of big issues, if you like, for us as believers. I mentioned Professor Cameron. He's a former colleague of mine, and studying. Well, he's not studying. He's working in the States at the moment. He's got various titles, but he came up with this analysis of bioethics. He put it into three sections, and he talks about taking life, making life, and faking life as the kind of three sections. And the taking life part is what we actually had a look at yesterday. And if you weren't here, you can listen, of course, to the downloads, which will be available on the website at some point. This is the old bioethics, bioethics one, if you like, the whole issues of abortion and euthanasia. And then making life, we talked a little bit about this yesterday. We talked about cloning and how that can work. This is bioethics two, as far as Nigel Cameron is concerned. We talked yesterday about the Human Fertilization Embryology Act. In 1990, just to catch up some of you who weren't here yesterday, the UK decided that it would be okay to store, manipulate, experiment on, and then destroy embryos in the laboratory. That's now legal because of the 1990 Act. And it's up to the age of 14 days of any embryo. You can do any of those things. There's no protection whatsoever for the embryo in that first 14 days. The only thing you have to do after 14 days is either implant, if it's still in a condition to implant in a woman's womb, or destroy it. That's what you must do with a human embryo. And of course, tied up with all of that work in the laboratory, we've now got considerable strides being made in genetic engineering and trying to manipulate, if you like, the bits and pieces of those embryos to come up with one that we really want. Now, I'm going to talk about various books and films this morning, and this is one of them that I want you to think about. How many have read Jodie Picoult's My Sister's Keeper? Can you just a handful of you, really. Okay. I'm going to recommend these various books to you, and they're all going to be fiction books, because I do fiction better than non-fiction. And we'll talk about films and that kind of thing as well. This book, My Sister's Keeper, it deals with this whole issue of the so-called savior sibling, the child who is created in such a way that that child can then be used for the benefit of an older sibling by way of tissue typing, the way of using the new child, as it were, as a farm, really, for parts for the older sibling. And this book deals with, I think, probably nearly all the emotional issues surrounding that particular subject, deals with some of the science as well, some of the medical issues. But reproductive technologies now, they've given us the option that we can select a particular embryo to grow into a perfect tissue donor for the existing sibling. This is a really controversial process at the moment, and the ones that have actually gone through the system have gone through into the higher courts in the UK for the courts to make decisions as to whether the scientists should be allowed to use these processes or not. The biology is already established. It's relatively straightforward. But the issue here is the creation of a child, not for his or her own sake, but as a means for an end for someone else. That's the ethical issue, if you like, that is crucial here. And, of course, the bigger issue even than that is not just what do you do with the child who's been created for a purpose other than him or herself, but what do you do about all the other embryos that were created, tested, and then destroyed because they weren't perfect enough to be a tissue match for the existing sibling. So there are big issues surrounding this whole issue. I don't know how many of you keep an eye on what's going on through our own parliament at the moment, but the Human Fertilization Embryology Bill has been chuntering its way through parliament for the last few months. And MPs and those in the Lords also have already approved this process of tissue typing. In other words, finding a match, if you like, for an existing child. And they are legalizing the creation of these so-called savior siblings. The idea initially is that cord blood can be used from that new sibling in order for blood transfusions or other cells to be created, other organs maybe even to be created from that. So that's what everyone talks about. We're only really interested in the cord blood of the new one, because that gives us the embryonic stem cells, if you like, that we need for the other child. But the trouble with the legislation as it goes through at the moment, it actually gives opportunity for any tissue to be taken from the new child who's been created. So it leaves the door open for at the age of 2 or 5 or 10 or 13, as comes in this book, My Sister's Keeper, and I won't tell you how the story works out, because you need to read the story for yourself to find out. But it could lead us to some all sorts of serious contentious issues 10 years down the road, when certain children are then that age, as to their own rights, as to whether they should just become donors for an older sibling. Where's the issues of consent in all of that? So the law as it stands at the moment, and it's got its final part of the passage through the Commons next Monday, in fact, on the 14th, third reading and report stage. And these things will be legalized. It'll be okay for us then to create made-to-measure children for limited purposes initially, of course. That kind of leads us on to the bigger topic, I suppose, of children being born to the design specifications of their parents. And I can imagine most of you sitting here this morning thinking, I'm glad my parents didn't make design specification decisions about me. It raises all sorts of issues about the individuals. There's all sorts of pressures at the moment in the UK for an increasing range of choices to be made available to parents as they come to this situation. Now, it's perfectly understandable that some parents might want to choose a child who doesn't have the genes of an inheritable disease that's rampant in their family already. You can well understand that. At some point, they might want to say, no, our family shouldn't be dogged by this disease anymore, which has been inherited through the generations. If there's a way of excluding that, a particular genetic part of an embryo, let's pick an embryo that hasn't got that gene. And you can understand that kind of emotional argument around it. But it, of course, has much bigger implications, as I've already mentioned, with all the other ethical issues that surround it. And how far, then, are you going to allow parents to go in the choice of their children? Are we going to get to the stage when we can choose a child for the particular gender that we want? I mean, some inheritable diseases only get passed down through the male line, for instance. So there may be an argument to say, well, if it's a female embryo, we don't want that, thank you very much. We'll do away with those. We'll just use... we'll do the male one. We'll do the female ones, not the male ones. So you might end up excluding embryos on the basis of their gender alone, whether they've got this inheritable disease or not. Other mental and other physical attributes can be chosen in this way. And these are the kind of issues that we're going to have to face. This is a gentleman I'm going to... there we go. I'm going to quote a couple of occasions today. Professor John Wyatt, he's a professor of neonatal pediatrics at University College. He works with very, very preterm babies. And he says this in this amazing book, Matters of Life and Death. If you haven't read that book and you're interested in the subject, get hold of it. It's an absolutely brilliant work on all of these issues. He says, modern parents are in danger of being control freaks. We want to control and design our children to fulfill our deepest desires. We want to live out our unfulfilled expectations in them. But a biblical perception of parenthood teaches us that we must let go. Although we have a responsibility to protect, nurture, and educate, we must also respect our children. Part of the ethical framework, if you like, that we need to be working within. We've got court cases that have been running through the courts in this country about these issues. We've got government consultations every few months relating to surrogacy, designer babies, these kind of things, putting out to the people, what do you think? What do you want to say about this? The future holds some very interesting prospects. Maybe Hollywood might have already have got there first. Let me show you this next clip.
Now you can design your own child. You can choose the sex.
We would want Vincent to have a brother.
You can decide how your child will look.
You have specified hazel eyes and fair skin.
You can even determine its future.
We were hoping that he would get married and have children.
Where can you do all this? In a place called Gattaca. Rated PG-13.
How many of you have heard or seen Gattaca? Oh, excellent. If those of you who haven't seen it, get it from eBay. It'll cost you about £4 or £5. It's very cheap because it's an older film. But it's a story of the triumph, basically, of the human spirit. That's how it's talked about. It's set in a future time when people have been genetically engineered to be better than others. And those that can afford to buy into that have produced a kind of super race and an underclass. And those in the super race, the ones who have been genetically manufactured, are the ones that get to go, in this case, into space. And it's the story of one guy who was outside of that group but wanted to prove that he could become an astronaut as well. It's a very, very good film. It's a good story in itself, but it also deals with some of these issues about genetic engineering. We can also do things to create life in the laboratory.
This is umbilical cord blood from a baby born in Newcastle this morning. Now, cord blood is rich in stem cells, the body's master cells. And what scientists here have done is they've grown those stem cells into chunks of liver tissue, a stepping stone towards the ultimate goal of creating artificial organs. So, how was it done? Well, the stem cells were placed in this small bioreactor developed by the space agency NASA. It contains a chemical cocktail which coaxes the stem cells to turn into liver tissue. And the circular motion encourages them to grow in 3D, in lumps. And this is the result. These are not miniature livers. They're just a few millimeters across. But even small pieces of liver could be a vital research tool, initially in helping to develop safer medicines.
We've produced lumps of liver up to about the size of a 1p coin, although they were very crude, clearly. In the future, we hope to develop these forward to something which is large enough to do full drug testing on, and this will help us to develop much better drugs, which are more like drugs that the human body will be able to take without side effects.
For charities which support liver research, it's a welcome development.
I think it probably is 10 or 15 years in the making. But the interesting thing is that the liver has got a really great ability to regenerate itself. So the possibility of generating up from a one pence size piece of liver tissue to something greater, something the size of a rugby ball, which is what the size of the liver is quite an exciting prospect.
Stem cell research is still in its infancy. The goal of creating artificial organs like livers is probably decades away, but scientists believe other clinical benefits could come much sooner. Fergus Walsh, BBC News, Newcastle.
You may have worked out that that was supposed to have a video commentary to it as well. BBC website doesn't let you download these clips. I only got the audio, so I apologise for that. But that's what's happening already in relation to livers. There's
Research team led by the heart surgeon Sir Magdi Yacoub has for the first time grown part of a human heart from stem cells. Sir Magdi has said that if tests on animals are successful, he believes that doctors could be using artificially grown heart components in transplants within 3 years. Heart disease is the UK's biggest killer. In the UK, in 2004 alone, there were more than 200,000 deaths from heart disease and strokes. And in 2003, nearly 10,000 people needed surgery to replace their heart valves with artificial ones. Well, joining me now from the Heart Science Centre at Harefield Hospital is Dr. Adrian Chester, who's been involved in the research. Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us. And congratulations, first of all, on what sounds like an extraordinary achievement. Just explain exactly which part of the heart you've managed to grow.
Yes, good afternoon. We've been trying to grow heart valve tissue. So the aortic valve is the main heart valve in the body, and it's that structure that we've been trying to replicate using tissue engineering techniques.
And you really think you might be able to use them on humans within 3 years? It seems like an incredibly short space of time.
I think that's it's difficult to estimate exactly when it will be ready. I think that is a timescale that could be achieved, but I think it would be fairer to look at perhaps a slightly longer timescale, because we don't know yet what additional problems or issues we may encounter while we're going through this process.
But just explain, if you're successful with this, how much of a difference it could make to, I mean, hundreds and thousands of people's lives?
Yes, I mean, heart valve surgery is quite common, and we would hopefully aim to prevent the need for reoperation of these people. The mechanical valves and the porcine tissue valves that are currently used work very well over a certain time period, but then in a certain number of people, they are required to be replaced for a second or sometimes third time. That's very important if you happen to be a younger person or a child. You don't really want the increased clinical risk of having continual reoperation. So the concept of having a tissue-engineered valve will be that the valve can grow with you as you grow and function almost identically to the native valve, which is a very complex structure that does more than just open and shut
just
in response to the blood.
Very briefly, I mean, what a lot of people are going to be wondering is how long then is it?
I'm going to stop them there because it's a bit boring, really. Scientists are so boring, aren't they, really? Any scientists here? Good. I offended three or four people. That's great. Stem cell research is giving us some amazing results at the moment. The prospect of growing a new liver, growing a new heart valve, or even a new heart, replacement valves, replacement organs for our bodies, is a hugely promising piece of technology. The problem is, where do you get the raw material from? And ethically, that's the big issue these days. Stem cell research falls into two categories, basically. Stem cell research on embryonic stem cells from human embryos, or adult stem cells taken from any part, as it were, of the adult body. And the research runs on both of those tracks at the moment. Now, there seems to me to be no ethical problems getting stem cells from adults. You've got a consent issue, and you've also got an issue if you use that person's own stem cells to grow them replacement organs. You've got no rejection issues either, because the body will receive the organ as its own. Whereas for an embryonic stem cell, you're dealing with a different individual, and growing organs for another person, a different person, might cause problems. There's also issues, of course, with embryonic stem cells, because you are creating embryos again to destroy them. You are creating an embryo in order to produce part of that embryo to use for the purpose of someone else. So embryonic stem cells, I believe ethically and certainly from theological perspective, are very dubious in their source. The argument goes that an embryonic stem cell is what the scientists call pluripotent. In other words, it can be engineered into any other type of cell that's needed for the body, whether it's a brain cell or a skin cell or a heart cell or a liver cell or whatever it happens to be. And the argument goes that adult stem cells aren't as pluripotent as embryonic stem cells. That argument doesn't stand up when you look at the research that's going on in the country at the moment, because there are over 80 clinical trials and treatments that are now being used using adult stem cells, and there are a big fat zero clinical trials and clinical applications from embryonic stem cell research. So those who support embryonic stem cell and the creation and destruction of embryos for that purpose have got themselves a practical problem as much as an ethical problem, because at the moment it's simply not working. There aren't any advantages coming to us from embryonic stem cells. So that's a big issue. Maybe we can talk about that as we go along. I'm not even going to move this one at all. I won't do the diabetes one because that's another clip. Now, we might be able to do some really, really good things with this technology. We might be able to grow spinal cord, to repair spinal cord for those with serious disabilities, broken backs. We might be able to, as I said earlier on, we might be able to come up with a vaccine against cancer, all sorts of things. But we do need to be very careful that the speed of scientific development doesn't run ahead of the speed of proper ethical consideration about these issues. It's not just a case of, if I can do it, I must do it. There are questions to ask whether you should. And just in case you think that this is actually all modern science, think about this. Mary Shelley wrote this in 1818. If human blood cells can grow outside the human body, why not human bone cells, muscle cells, and nerve cells? And eventually all of them together functioning as a single living organism. Does anyone know who or what she was talking about? Frankenstein. She thought in 1818 we could do this, and that's brought us this.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
When this dead hand moves, the monster created by a man they called Mad is turned loose to strike terror into the hearts of men. To shock women into uncontrolled hysteria.
It's Elizabeth!
To prey upon the innocence of children.
I didn't put it in for any purpose. I just think it's a really funny bit of film to watch. We had a look at the making life section yesterday. So we talked about cloning. I'm not going to move on. I'm going to move on past that and go to the next section, which is that of faking life, the third, bioethics three in Professor Cameron's view about biotechnology. Now, faking life is actually very interesting, I find it anyway. It's about, in essence, it's about the blending of people and machines, the coming together, if you like, of those two things. Improving, if you like, on the original by putting in technical enhancements. That's essentially what we're talking about. And it's already been, it's already happened in to some extent. Do you know who this guy is? Oscar Pistorius, so-called Blade Runner. He's a disabled athlete who has no legs but uses these amazing carbon fiber legs to run, and he's now been cleared to run in the Olympics, I think, this year, so that should be fun. Interestingly enough, those legs are called cheetahs, not as in E-A-T-E-R-S, but cheetahs as in the animals that run very fast. What about these people? Does anyone know what these have got in common? Drugs? They're all drug cheats. One of them may be running in the Olympics as well this summer. I don't know if you have any particular views on that. We won't talk about that, I don't think, particularly. But these people have tried to use drugs to get an advantage in their particular sport. And they've used these so-called performance-enhancing drugs. And actually, that's a pretty low-tech way of getting an enhancement. Because rather than the performance-enhancing drug, why not have the performance-enhanced athlete, the one who gets a direct injection of his own genetic material to increase the performance of his muscles, maybe just before a particular event, a speed event or an endurance event, almost impossible to detect by those that deal with the drug cheats, because, of course, what the athlete will be doing is using his or her own genetic material to enhance his or her performance. That's a genetic improvement on the original. But how far is it going to go? Let me just show you what Patrick Dixon, I don't know how many of you know Dr. Patrick Dixon, he's a very famous Christian ethicist and futurist now. He says, we urgently need gene technology to feed the world and cure disease. But we do need to take great care over what kind of world we are creating. Now we have the ability to alter the very basis of life itself. So he's encouraging the technology, but saying, let's think about this very carefully about what we're doing before we take steps. Because the question is, do we really understand what's going to happen when we try and experiment in gene manipulation? Do we really know what will happen in the next generation and 10 generations down? Are there going to be unforeseen and very unpleasant consequences? I don't know how many of you have seen this film, but I guess this also gets to the core of that as well.
Nothing happened the way it was supposed to happen. My name is Robert Neville. I'm a survivor living in New York City. I am broadcasting on all AM frequencies. If you are out there, if anyone is out there, please.
Will Smith in I Am Legend. Who's seen that film? Great. Did you enjoy it? Scary. No? Everything with Will Smith is worth watching, surely. Basically, the storyline is cancer vaccine developed by, I thought very unfairly, by an English scientist. You know, that's they put that in American film, the bad guy or the bad woman is an English scientist. Anyway, she creates this vaccine against cancer. And very soon after people start taking it, they start to mutate, basically, and become rabid, horrible beings that attack you in the night. And this spreads right across the world, and terrible consequences happen. And if you like special effects and you like being scared, it's a really, really great film. If you like Will Smith, if you like dogs, don't go and see it. Okay, just a warning. So that's something. The reason I show you these films is not just to say, you know, to break up so you don't have to listen to me all the time. The reason I'm showing these things and talking to you about books and films is that often the creators of our fiction get there first. They are thinking through some of the issues that we're dealing with, and they're presenting us with a scenario. This is what it could look like. And obviously, the science is not always entirely accurate, but some of the scenarios I think are. Scientists are really about, I think, trying to create what effectively they're looking for is the perfect body. There we go. The perfect body. You can take your choice as to which one you like, but you can probably have eventually whichever one you do want, because that's part of this whole genetic engineering possibility of parents being able to choose for their children the attributes of size and weight and hair color, intellect, sporting ability. You heard some of those things in the Gattaca clip. You know, you have chosen hazel eyes and whatever, that kind of thing. How parents will be able to choose. Maybe even in being able to enhance the human brain, how cool would this be, by computer chips that just slot in. I've watched the films as well. Which film was that in? Sorry? Matrix, that's right. When you want to fly a helicopter, just put in a chip into your brain and away you go. These are the kind of things that we might get to. Who knows? What about creating a hybrid? A hybrid between a man and a chimpanzee. And this is, again, been the subject of a number of books and films over the years, creating what's known as a human Z, okay? And this book, Michael Crichton's grasp on science is kind of limited, I think. But his grasp on the issues is very, very strong. He wrote Jurassic Park, if you remember how all that started, with a little mosquito being found in a piece of amber and all that kind of business, recreating dinosaurs and things. But he wrote this book called Next, and it's about, again, a science experiment that went wrong when they crossed a human with a chimpanzee, and a human-looking child was born as a result of this particular experiment, which should have been stopped but wasn't stopped because the scientists wanted to continue with it. And then he took this child, they called it David, I don't know why they called it David, but that was the name they gave to him, and it was his struggle, if you like, to discover who am I, when he discovered something about his hairiness, which was a bit of a problem for him. He seemed to have much more hair growth than his peers, as it were. Who am I? Maybe it might be an option at some point to create some kind of hybrid that could do really difficult and dangerous tasks for us as human beings. And again, these are the kind of things that writers are looking at, filmmakers are looking at, but you need to know that our own UK Parliament has now agreed, and will be on the statute books in a week or so's time, that we can create human and animal hybrids in the laboratory. Of course, for purely research purposes, is the way they would describe it. And the Human Fertilisation Embryology Authority, which is the overarching body that looks after all these issues of ethics and science, they've now granted a licence just last week to the University of Warwick to create human pig embryos. They're called in the legislation, they're now called admixed embryos. This is the usual way that politicians try and just fudge the issues by changing the language. They started off as animal-human hybrids. I've got a fly. I must be as cool as Mark Driscoll. They started off calling them animal-human hybrids, but now they call them admixed embryos, so that it's just obfuscation of language, basically. That's what's going on here. Try and change the language and hope they don't notice. Question. If you make a human monkey embryo and it does actually grow to term, let's say it does happen, how human does this particular being have to be to need salvation in our terms? Would this being have the image of God imprinted on it, him, her, whatever we call it? Or even, how many human genes does there have to be in something for it to qualify for human rights and the protections that come from human rights? Now, you may think, oh, come on, you're just being a bit silly here. This is getting a bit far-fetched. Well, just for a moment, have a look at this document. If I can get this thing to move. Come along. There we go. You see what that document says? This is it here. The dignity of living beings with regard to plants. Okay? This is an official document of the Federal Ethics Committee on Non-Human Biotechnology in Switzerland. Okay? They spent a lot of time and energy as scientists deciding whether there were moral considerations to be looked at in relation to plants. In other words, do they have rights? And this is a serious document. So if they're talking about rights for plants, there's certainly going to be issues about rights for admixed beings if they actually grow into a form when they can have those rights. So the question I want to ask us, and we can discuss it together, I guess, are we more than just the makeup of our genes? Is there something else that makes us human? Where does the image of God fit in all of this? Where does it come? Now, I want to just briefly run into the issue of nanotechnology, because, again, this is a huge issue and will be a huge issue in the future. And nanotechnology is basically the manipulation of microscopic atoms, individual atoms, and how those can be put together in a form that can help us or sometimes maybe even hinder us. It's the science, basically, of very, very tiny objects. Nanotechnology is going to bring us all sorts of new technologies in the next few years. It's going to be involved in genetics, in robotics, in IT, all sorts of artificial intelligence, all sorts of things. The UK government just a few years ago issued a report on this, and they said this: the ultimate goal of nanotechnology is to produce tiny devices, some of which may be able to design and build other devices that will have an inbuilt way of working somehow. Now, one goal of this whole nanotech thing is to use nanorobots within the human body, sending them in to do a particular task within us. Maybe to detect and destroy cancerous cells. That's one thing that's been looked at in research terms. Other infected bits of the body, maybe even to repair some kind of genetic mutilation that's occurred in the human body. Maybe even to deliver a drug therapy very specifically to a particular place and part of the body. These are the kind of applications, if you like, that are being looked at. We already have many commercial products on the market that include nanotech products. It includes such ridiculous things as sun cream, tennis rackets, dental fillings, dressings for burns, and many, many other products that have got this tiny nanotechnology within them. Scientists have even implanted nanorobots into rats' brains so that they can control by a computer what the rat actually does in the laboratory. This is already happening in research. And actually, for human purposes, some of the research is close now to being able to give us neurons in our brains which could then speak to a computer directly or even control limbs. Now, that would be fantastic if you're a paraplegic and you want to control your computer or maybe control new limbs that you've been given. These kind of things are being developed. We've also moved into engineering viruses as well in the laboratory, maybe to act as machines or maybe as weapons in warfare. Sounds great, doesn't it? All these things that could happen. But Michael Crichton has got there again, ahead of the scientists. He's written this book also called Prey. In the Nevada desert, an experiment has gone horribly wrong. A cloud of nanoparticles, micro-robots, has escaped from the laboratory. This cloud is self-sustaining and self-reproducing. It's intelligent and learns from experience. For all practical purposes, it's alive. It's been programmed as a predator for the war, for a fighting situation. It's evolving swiftly, becoming more deadly with each passing hour. Every attempt to destroy it has failed, and we, human beings, are the prey. If you haven't read that book, have a read of it again. It's a great story. It's probably rubbish science in places, but it's the kind of book that can flag up to us where we might end up if we go too far down these roads without thinking about the things. How far do we go to enhance the original design? When have we gone too far? What does it mean to be human? I think that's X-Men, isn't it? And is this Fantastic Four? How many of you are daft enough to go and see those films? Come on, I know more of you probably seen them. They're about mutations. What is human? Is the human going to develop in any way? Again, Hollywood's view. But do we want, maybe, the prospect of being able to enhance the eyesight of our military pilots? That would be a really good thing to be able to do, so they can see further and sharper and better. Maybe we want to increase the strength, physical strength, of our soldiers on the battlefield. You know, you may say, well, this sounds like sci-fi, but let me just show you a clip from the Reuters news agency about something in the States.
Reuters.
While American soldiers get in shape stateside with a slew of aerobic exercises, a soldier of the future could soon be seen on the battlefield. It's called an exoskeleton, and by stepping inside this robotic exterior, a soldier can easily perform feats that years ago could only be seen in science fiction movies. The exoskeleton, first developed by Utah-based Sarcos 6 years ago, allows its users to lift hundreds of pounds easily and also perform everyday tasks such as walking upstairs, running, or even walking on one's heels.
He uses get out of way control, which follows from his end effectors, the feet and the hands, and the machine will just follow where he goes.
Sarcos says exoskeletons in various models will be covered, offering different levels of protection for the soldier inside. The U.S. is hoping the exoskeleton represents a major advance for the soldier of tomorrow. John Decker, Reuters.
How cool is that? Who'd like one of those? Yeah. Yes, I think so. That's great. I just wonder whether it reminds you of something. If you've seen the Star Wars films, that's really what you're talking about with the clones. Oh,
we designed them
and robots
with our homes, with our way of life, with our world. But did we design them to be trusted?
The rollout of USR's new generation of robot, the NS5, was marred by the death of designer Alfred Lanning.
Identifier. Murder's a new trick for a robot. Respond.
I did not murder him!
We're gonna miss the good old days.
What good old days?
When people were killed by other people.
My robots don't kill people.
That thing threw somebody out of a window. Is that registering with you?
A robot cannot harm a human being.
And you trust them if you want to.
We looked at robots for protection. Imagine the loss of all that we've gained because of an irrational paranoia.
Does thinking you're the last sane man on the face of the earth make you crazy? Because if it does, maybe I am.
Maybe you can be looking in the shadows all the time.
On the inside, help me find out what is wrong with these robots.
Dr. Lanning suggested robots might naturally evolve.
I was hoping to see you again, Detective. Think of me as your friend.
Why didn't you just hand the world over on a silver platter?
Maybe we did.
We are on the eve of the largest robotic distribution in history. There'll be one robot to every five humans.
How many robots have ever committed a crime? How many robots in the world?
None.
There is no conspiracy. What this is one mistake.
Oh, hell no.
Somehow, I told you so, just doesn't quite say it.
you remain suspicious of me, Detective.
You know what they say about old dogs?
Not really.
Gotcha.
Told you Will Smith was cool. We're going down this road. Increasingly humanoid-type robots. Who knows where it'll take us? Maybe we're going to follow down the transhuman route, which is one I talked about earlier on. This idea that we can free ourselves from the confines of the original design by bringing into our bodies some extra help, as it were, from the outside, the blending of people and machines. Now, the main problem with most of these new technologies is not that they're all wrong. Actually, many of them are going to bring us all sorts of great benefits. But the problem is that most of them are developed behind closed doors. And they're developed behind closed doors mostly for commercial reasons, which is really what the iRobot film was trying to convey, that there are commercial pressures that may push people to make decisions which wouldn't necessarily be good for human life as a whole. And our ability to reflect theologically or ethically is really difficult when we don't actually know what's happening in these kind of commercial settings. There is a big question, I guess, and I'll just leave this for you to think about. Is all this actually part of a new kind of religion that we're building in this 21st century to reverse the effects of the fall and to put man back in the place where Satan wants him to be, in the place of God? It's a big question as to whether that's actually spiritually what's behind all of these things. What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be made in the image of God? I'm going to have the last word to Professor Wyatt again. He's here using the language of the art restorer and the ethics of the art restoration world. And he says this: if we see our bodies as wonderful, original, artistic masterpieces reflecting the design of God, but marred by biological and moral flaws, what is our responsibility to this masterpiece, and what can we do with it? Ethical intervention is that which seeks to protect, maintain, and restore the original, operating within the parameters fixed by the artist, in our case, by God himself. Unethical restoration is that which seeks to enhance, alter, or improve the original design. Actually, I'll leave that quote up there because I think it's such a helpful summary. Right. That's all I'm going to say. So I'm opening now for you to comment, ask questions, take us into other realms or back to things you wanted to talk about from yesterday, which you didn't deal with, if that's what you want to do. So, has anybody got a question? Yeah. Oh, front row. The question, in case it wasn't picked up for people listening, was is heart surgery something which improves on the original design? Is that then unethical in John Wyatt's definition? I don't think that's what he's saying, because you're not putting, as it were, a better heart than God could have made back into the person, or making it better than it would have been before. Ooh, lunch. Excuse that. What the doctor... Any more to come through at all?
No.
No, all right. Okay. It's nice to have your seminar in a corridor, isn't it? I don't think the doctors are there trying to make a better deal than God made. What they're trying to do is give you back what it should have been in the first place, maybe because of a disease in the heart, heart valves, heart bypasses, that kind of stuff. Even heart transplants, you could say, Maybe you're getting a younger heart sometimes, but it's not a better one, I don't think, than the original that God would have intended. Well, I think, as I say, the point is, what would it have looked like in its original form? I think that's the question. And what it would have looked like is a fully functioning, perfect heart. And if you can, even if you put in some mechanical way of helping that, say a mechanical valve, which people have all the time, or a pacemaker, something like that, which allows the heart to beat as it should, that's not improving on the original. That's simply getting it back to what it ought to have been. It's like the art restorer, as John's trying to say there, you get a very messy, mucky, old-looking picture, and you know that's not what the original artist meant. So you start to clean it very carefully with whatever chemicals will work in that situation, and you get back to the original shine, the original hues, the original colours that the artist wanted you to see. Are you improving it? In one sense, you're improving it from its rough old version, but you're not improving it on the original artist's intention. And I think that's what John's trying to convey. It's not easy always to apply it individually, but I think if we just try and bear that in mind, that's what he's trying to say. Yes? Yes. That's a very interesting question. That's a much bigger question, really, particularly about children born with Down syndrome. Is that actually how they were intended to be? Is, I guess, the big religious, theological question. Did God mean that, or is it actually a mar of the fall? And if you gave a child who has a malfunctioning heart, as many Down's children do, if you gave them a new heart, is that improving on the original? I think that's what you're saying, no. Is the answer. I don't think it is, because again, the original design is one of a fully functioning human being. And again, yes, for the Downs child, that child is getting a better heart than he or she was born with, but you're not giving them a better heart than they would have had if they didn't have Down syndrome. You see what I'm getting at? There's a big issue actually for parents with Down syndrome. Good friends of ours who we worked with in the Bournemouth church, they're fourth child was born with Down syndrome. And a number of well-meaning and kindly people at the time offered to pray for little Daniel to be, quotes, healed, unquotes, from his Down syndrome. Our friends, Ken and Sue, decided that wasn't what they wanted to happen. They wanted to embrace what God had done. What God had decided for this little boy. They took the view that this is the design that God had in mind for Daniel. He was that design in God's eyes. Now, you can debate that theologically, ethically, medically, in all sorts of ways, but that's the conclusion. Just for those on the tape, the lady with the trolley is now going back where she's just come from, but there's no food on the trolley this time. And I'm hoping that's where I'm going to have my lunch. There's a big debate around this whole issue of disability generally, isn't there? Does God intend blindness? Scripture tells us, yes, I have made them blind and deaf, is what Scripture says on occasions, because God has designed people in particular ways. Can he heal them from that deafness and make them hear again? Yes, of course he can. Will he heal a Down syndrome child? Well, if you've been following the Lakeland outpouring, you will know that there is a claim coming out of that, in the first few weeks of the outpouring, that a child who was born with Down syndrome, a young boy, was prayed for, and they're claiming healing from Down syndrome in the sense that his facial features even have altered since they prayed for him back to a, quotes, normal, unquotes, whatever that is, child of his same age. So there seems to be the possibility of God doing whatever God wants to do, which I suppose in the end is this big picture that I talked about at the beginning. What does the Bible say? Well, the Bible says God is sovereign, and God will make some decisions which are outside our parameters of understanding. And that's not a theological cop-out. I think it's just theological truth, really. Question here. The question basically is about ethics and ethical intervention, non-ethical, in relation to children who suffer serious disabilities, maybe in the womb, pre-birth. Okay, without intervention would die. Is it unethical to intervene then to save the life of that child? Whoa. No. Is my answer to that one. Again, what are you looking to do? Are you looking to give that child what would everybody else would have? The answer is yes. You're looking to give that child a life that the child wouldn't have otherwise. Are you improving on the original? You're improving on the original in the sense that the fallen version in front of you is not working properly and you want to make it work properly. So you're improving on that original. But are you improving on God's original intention in the sense of a fully functioning, well human being? No, you're not. So I guess the answer to your question is, no, I don't think it's unethical. Do I think it's unethical to abort a Down's child? Is that a question you have as well? Yeah. Yeah. Well, what you're saying is maybe having a flu jab could be unethical intervention because it's helping you to stay free from disease, having measles, jabs, whatever. That's an argument. I'm not criticizing that argument. Some people have that argument, actually. They don't want to do things to interfere, if you like, with the normal process of life. But if you take that view, then you wouldn't have antibiotics for an infection in your leg, let's say, and you would probably die from septicemia. Is that the right approach? No, I don't think it is, because God's created scientists and medics with brains, which they use, to help us avoid the worst effects of the fall on the original. And sin has marred every part of God's creation. We know that. And sin and sickness is part of that. So if doctors are helping us to avoid sin and sickness and disability, then they're not doing something which is unethical. They're simply looking to what the original would have been, which would have been a healthy body, and try to get us back to that. So, I mean, I'm wearing glasses. Is that an unethical intervention? Because God might want me to be very short-sighted and bump into things and people. I mean, you could easily take the argument to extremes. Hearing aids for people who can't hear properly. You know, these are not unethical interventions, in my view. They're medical helps. I know you're still quizzical about that, but can I just move on to another one? We can have a chat afterwards if you want to. Yes, the chap at the back. Well, this is that's almost on the kind of, I think, on the cusp of the argument here, really. If you're creating something in genetic engineering terms, which makes your eyesight better than it would have been even if you had 20/20 vision, okay, so you've now got whatever better than 20/20 is. I don't know what better than 20/20 is, but let's say far-sightedness, you can see a lot further maybe than normal people, then I think you're in the realms there of difficulty, because that's not, quotes, natural, unquotes. The eyes are meant to function in 20/20 vision. But if they're better than that, it seems to me that you may have problems in moving into that area, improving on what God intended in the first place. So I think there's a line there. This is obviously causing a lot of thought because there's a lot of hands up. Let's go. Let's chap at the back. Sorry, there's just two. Sorry, no, behind you, and then I'll come to you. Where's the line? Where's the line between what God intended us to use and what God didn't intend us? Again, I suppose my simple answer to that is that question is I haven't got the faintest idea in general. In specifics, there are principles I guess we have to try and apply to this, don't we, really? What are the principles here of the sovereignty of God, that he made us in a way which reflects him? He gave us intelligence to use. Yes, yes, yes. Does he give us freedom to go outside of the design that he's shown us? That's the question. How far has he given us responsibility as human beings? He's given us a responsibility to make good decisions and to make bad decisions. We know that from what Scripture tells us about Adam in the first place. He had freedom to choose. Go the way God wanted, go the way God doesn't want. So I guess there has to be a point in a medic's or a research medic's activity where the potential is for you to make the wrong decision, to do something which is actually sinful rather than going the way God wants, because that's the way God's designed us. Now, we can talk about free will and, you know, predestination and all those other things ad nauseam, but I guess the answer is there could be something that you would want to do which you shouldn't do. Now, unless we talk specifics, it's difficult to tie that down, but the principles must be that that is possible. And therefore, it should be in your thinking as a believer with a Christian worldview that there could be a line over which I should not tread. And we know, because we've talked about it, the methods, the means often is a problem. The end often is a very good end in all of these things. You're trying to relieve sickness and ill health. It's often the means that you use to get there which causes the problem, which is why we talk about embryo research. Yes, we can get to a good end of dealing with genetic inheritable diseases, let's say. But if you get there by killing thousands of embryos along the way, is that the route we should be taking? That's the question I would ask you. And I'm not going to necessarily answer all the questions for you. I'll give you my view. But there must be a point when we say the means no longer justifies the end. However good the end happens to be, the means of getting there simply is wrong, and we mustn't take those steps. And if we're bright enough, as research scientists or medics or whatever, you will find a way. You'll find an ethical way, maybe not the easiest way. As with the embryo stem cells and the adult stem cells, there are problems with adult stem cells that you don't get with embryonic stem cells, but you can overcome those if you have a view which says, I won't go that way, but I will go another way, which I believe is an ethical route. So I guess those are the principles to try and apply. Individual situations are going to be very specific. Gentleman in front of you, then we'll come. Have you got your hand up? I'll come to you in just a moment. Yeah. Are genetic enhancements any different to mechanical enhancements? Yeah. Yes, I think there is a difference. I think there is a difference because it's about the essential makeup of the human being. What does it mean to be human? I don't change my humanity by sticking binoculars on my eyes. You know, I do a lot of bird watching. I use binoculars all the time. It's not changing me. It's just changing the image that I see. In my case, I need binoculars, strong binoculars. So I don't think that there is clearly a difference between a mechanical aid and something which changes you inherently. Mechanical implants. Mechanical implant to enhance your memory. I don't know how that would work. You'd have to have some kind of electronic computerized one. Like the Matrix. I'd love to be able to fly a helicopter at a moment's notice, wouldn't you? Maybe I'm just, you know, a big kid, I don't know. But there is a difference. There is a difference between those two things. If you're enhancing something which wouldn't happen with God's original creation, then I think you are in a realm that you've got to be careful about. And I'm not saying there's a total kind of taboo on that, but it's just to ask these questions. When I'm looking at this thing, when I'm thinking about this, is this actually ethical or unethical? And as always with ethics, you can put four ethicists in a room discussing and you'll get five opinions. You know, that's the way it is. That's the way with ethics. There's always different paradigms of thinking. So somebody will come to one conclusion, someone will come to another conclusion. That's the way it is. Christians will come to different conclusions. We come to different conclusions on all the big life issues, contraception and assisted reproduction and abortion and all those big... There's a wide range, probably in this room even, there's a wide range of views on those, I would see, quite straightforward ethical issues. So there's going to be a myriad of opinions on the kind of things that we could do. I mean, is it Will Smith in iRobot who's actually got a mechanical arm, hasn't he? Is that right? Which is, again, a really cool thing to have. It's much stronger than the original, and it helps him to, you know, save the world, as Will Smith does. Is that unethical, that he's got a better arm because it's computerized and made out of material that is much, much stronger than the human skin and bones and everything else? I don't know. Actually, it depends, I suppose, what he uses it for, in one sense. If he uses it to save the world, that's fine by me, you know? I know I'm being a bit flippant here, but those are the kind of issues we could move into if we're going into mechanical limbs and electronically controlled limbs from brain implants. So I did say I'd come to this chat first. Is that all right? Is that fly back again? Could nanotechnology take us into the revelation times? It's a good thing it's nearly 12:45, isn't it, really? I suppose with all human thought and intuition and invention, anything could be used to oppress us during the time of whatever it's going to be in the last days. You know, the whole thing about the barcode on your forehead and, you know, not being able to get food without the mark of the beast and all that kind of stuff. Are we going to have implants in our arms which are barcoded so we can only buy stuff at Sainsbury's if we've got that barcode implanted in our arms? Is that the mark of the beast? I have absolutely no idea. It could be. It could take us down that road where we could be controlled by others who have a malign intention against us, or who would want to know where we are and what we're doing, which, of course, is the whole 1984 scenario, which was about the surveillance society, which he thought was going to come in 1984, has actually come in 2008. But there we are. We got there eventually, where the government sees physically everything that you're doing by way of surveillance in your homes, in your streets. Is that part of the mark of the beast? Is that part of the Antichrist? I have no idea. But it could well be. On the other hand, it might not be. One more, and then we've got to go because it's lunchtime. This lady had her hand up. I'm sorry, first. Okay, is there a weaker brother argument here? Is effectively what you're saying. Something that offends my conscience might not offend your conscience. And what do I do with that then? I suppose it's you have to apply the same principles to modern issues. And the way we've applied those principles in the past are things like smoking or drinking or going to the cinema or doing things that some Christians really think are are outside of the boundaries of proper Christian living. So if you're free in your life to drink alcohol, but someone else next to you is an ex-alcoholic or something like that, you would consider not drinking because of the sake of your weaker brother. That's the kind of scenario. And I suppose you just got to apply you've got to keep applying those same principles through. And it may be in some circumstances that you, because of your circumstances or in your family, something needs to be done in a nanotech way, in a high-tech biotechnology type of way, to help someone who's maybe dying or very seriously injured or something. And you may make a decision based on your love for that and concern for that individual, which is actually something that I would maybe see to say, well, I'm not sure about that, because it's got wider implications. If you do that for that individual, it could mean something else for this person over here, because the vulnerable people might be affected by it. That's the euthanasia argument. We didn't talk a lot about that yesterday, but that's the kind of argument we'd use. We'd say, I can understand why you'd want it for this individual, but if you allow it for that individual, what about the vulnerable person over here, who then will be affected by that decision three steps down the road? So it's the usual stuff, really. Counsel from someone, talk to friends, get wisdom from others, talk it through, and you have to come to a conclusion in the end. And if it offends your conscience, then you don't do it. If you haven't got faith for it in the spiritual context, you don't do it. But if there's a clarity in your thinking and you're happy with it, well, I guess you stand or fall before God on those kind of decisions, don't you, really? And it's the same in biotech as it would be in, do I drink and do I go to the cinema? Not quite so important issues, I guess, but they are the 21st century issues. I'm going to have to stop, I'm afraid. I'm happy to stay here for a few minutes and chat to anybody who wants to. Thank you very much for coming, and have a great conference.